Speaking of another Canadian, Leonard Cohen is probably a Canadian legend. Whether you see him as a soulful poet, a successful novelist, an habitué of Montreal bistros, or as an expatriate on a Greek island, you probably know something about the man. He has 8 albums out now, and when Vicky spoke with him last May, he was still working on his latest recording, and he had just published his 8th book of poetry, The Book of Memory. Vicky was pleased to meet him, finally.
I've often wondered if you really existed, because I've seen you in performance, but years ago. And then you're so ethereal, you disappear all the time.
Well, it takes a long time to prepare the work that I put out, so I generally don't do anything for 3 or 4 years between anything that I've done.
Does it alarm your publishers that when you don't appear for 6 years or something?
No, I think Joel Jack McClelland, you know, I bump into him and have a drink with him from time to time, so we know each other. We know that each of us exists.
And eventually something will come, will be produced. We'll present with him. Yes. Well, after each and every time that you do produce something, do you feel as if maybe this is the last one? Does that ever occur to you?
I think you always, you're always grateful for what you get, and there's always an anxiety that it's all used up.
When did you start writing these 50?
I started writing them about 2 years ago. They took about a year to assemble, and they're the result of a certain kind of place that I found myself for 3 or 4 years, where I felt the need to look into my own traditions and scriptures and roots.
I mean, do you make that decision one afternoon walking down the street?
No, I don't think this is a book you can write on the basis of a decision. You either find yourself up against a wall in some kind of trouble, and this is the only thing that can penetrate the silence that you find yourself in.
I would think that this is the order in which these are found now is not necessarily the order that they were originally written.
It's more or less the order, but
is it?
There are things that had to be moved around.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember which one you did first? I mean, I have a bet with myself, but which
no,
one?
No, I don't recall if that was. It was one of the early ones.
Yes, I thought it might be the one. It's number 33. Do you know them by heart? Which one number 33 is? It's the one really to your son. A prayer about your son's well-being.
That one I remember very well. That wasn't the very first, no. But I remember the circumstance of that one very, very much.
Was there any great joy in preparing these? I mean, did you feel relieved each time you would prepare one?
I felt a certain release because they are prayers and it's difficult to talk about this, but in the midst of the writing, the prayer is answered, and that's when the psalm ends, is when the deliverance comes.
And you feel release.
You feel the release, yes.
Where did you write these? In any particular place?
I wrote these mostly in a little trailer.
Trailer?
Yeah, I was living in a trailer in the south of France, in the countryside.
Like a caravan?
Caravan, yeah.
And a camping ground or in a...
No, it was on a piece of property that was owned by someone I knew, and they just let me park it at the corner.
That's all right.
It was great. It was great.
I've often...
lived in one of those?
No, but I've been in France quite a bit. I used to be married to a Frenchman, so we would make the yearly trek to visit the mother and father. And I would look at the camping grounds, and I would think, what a horror... They would cheek by jowl, these little caravans, and they would go from living cheek by jowl into the same situation, and always dusty. And
right on the edge of the road.
Yeah, just a nightmare. I could never figure out how people could do that, but I guess escape is escape, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, so let's get over that. We were going to ask you to read some of these things, but I think that it's not the right condition sitting in a studio to do this.
I tried once or twice in this book tour where interviews have asked me to read it, but you really freeze because these are about as personal as you can get, and it's very hard to pray in public.
I must say, you've never been prone to secrecy about what you do and the way you live or have lived, but this really goes through the core, you know. It is so personal. It is devastating.
It is an attempt to speak from the deepest place.
Well, do you think that takes a certain kind of bravery? I mean, reviewers have all said that it was extremely bold of you to do this.
I sometimes worried about the indiscretion of the thing. You know, I thought, first of all, you know, there's a very good book of Psalms that we already have.
Yes.
And there's no urgency to produce another one. But it was the only thing I could say. And that confers on it a certain legitimacy. And I know that they're true.
Mm-hmm.
So, and I think that they could be useful to one or two people here and there.
I would think so. I think they're quite uplifting, to be perfectly frank.
Yeah, well, one is driven into these kinds of words that are unfashionable, but they save me.
Mm-hmm.
So that maybe they
can
have that effect. From despair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think you approach this subject unless you're driven to it, unless all the other avenues of expression are blocked.
You were going to call it the Book of Psalms, but you changed your mind, I take it.
Yeah, because I first of all, I want to avoid a reference to the great book that David wrote.
Mm-hmm.
And they're not all of them are not properly psalms, so I tried to stay away from that.
When are they not properly psalms?
Well, I think that that psalms, by their nature, have to have an element of rejoicing in it, although that's not entirely absent. But I think these are more conversations with the absolute. They're more they fall or find themselves in a certain kind of intimacy that involves doubt and involves anger, involves despair, and asks for help. Where I think the psalms are more of a celebration.
Yes. Were there more than 50?
There were a few more than 50. But some of them were, it is true. And on assembling them, it became very, very clear. It wasn't a difficult choice. Some of them just didn't ring.
Mm-hmm. Might they later reworked?
I don't think I would rework these. I was ready to stay in this landscape as long as it was necessary. I don't think it's one you want to return to. And as soon as the deliverance came, the inspiration went.
You still go on your retreat?
Well, I've been studying with an old Japanese gentleman for many years, who's a friend. And
with whom you drink
with whom
cognac.
I drank cognac. He taught me how to drink. People ask me, what did you learn from him? I said, how to drink cognac.
How do you drink it? A lot of it?
A lot is one of the aspects. He's just become a close friend, and it's nothing special outside of a friendship. I've been fortunate to have friendships with people of other generations,
mm-hmm.
up and down. So this is, it's just nice to have an older guy around the house.
Yeah, they seem to know things.
They know a bit more than you.
Yeah, they sure do. But what I don't understand is how one can sit. I mean, I have trouble with 5 minutes, but I guess that's because I'm ill-skilled, that's a word, doesn't matter if it is, to sit for 16 hours.
Well, it's not necessary unless you know, they say that the Zen people are the Marines of the spiritual world.
Mm.
If you have that kind of nature that is attracted to the ordeal or to a certain vigorous kind of practice, then that's a place for you. But there's nothing, there's a saying in Zen, better not to begin.
Than to blow it?
Well, it's a severe practice, and it's really not for everybody. And the fact that it's difficult is no guarantee of its effectiveness. It's just, there are many traditions around, and it's a matter of finding one that in which you can dissolve yourself for a little while.
Do you find that, I think the first time you went, you were pretty... you weren't convinced.
First time I went, I couldn't believe it because there was this Japanese master and there was a German abbot, and it was on the top of a mountain. There was snow and we were marching around in the snow at 3 a.m. I thought it was the revenge of World War II. and I got out of it as fast as I could, but something about it stayed in my mind, and I started coming back more and more frequently until I began to understand what it was about.
What is it about? Please, you tell me. Oh, Leonard, you must know. What does it all mean?
It's just a matter of getting straight with yourself from time to time, and it's these decisions are not made out of luxury. There are times that you just feel you have to, do a little exercise.
Do you do any physical exercise? I mean, you don't appear to be a tennis player, any...
I'm pretty tough.
Is that so? In what area?
Well, I until very recently, when I messed up my knee, I used to work out every day. And then when I messed up my knee, I took up light weightlifting. But then I messed up my back.
Very nice.
So my knee's in pretty good shape now. So I'm going to try to get back.
You can get new parts, you know. I was watching the television only this morning where they tell me I can get new knees.
I like Mordecai Richard's book about that. Did you ever read that book of his? I think it's called... I don't know. It's about this millionaire that has keeps a kind of harem, a male and female of people whose livers and kidneys he uses. It's a wonderful book.
Yeah, it's a good thought, too. Perhaps if we were born 200 years hence, we could have everything replaced. I think that we've missed that boat.
Yeah, I don't know. I think, you know, whatever the span allotted us is sufficient. I wouldn't want to
sufficiently more for some than for others. Yeah, the great Julian Bream playing Rodrigo's Concerto de Aranjuez. Is that right?
I think that's it, yeah.
Yeah, Leonard Cohen, he chose that. Boy, that was great, wasn't it?
Yeah, very beautiful.
Yeah. You may think that this is blasphemous to say this, but I remember when I was a kid, my dad took me to the movie, the only movie he ever really took me to, and it was El Cid. Remember that movie?
No.
No. You weren't going to movies like that, I guess. Anyway, they played that thing all through the whole picture, and I sobbed and carried on. It is a tearjerker, isn't
it?
Yeah,
it's very, very emotional.
Is that what you listen to? Do you listen to a lot of music?
Well, I don't have I've been moving around a lot, and I don't carry cassettes, so... But that is a piece that I like to put on from time to time. It was a taxi driver was playing in his car the other day. That's why I was thinking of it.
That's nice for a change.
Yeah.
Usually they've got the country and western music on, which I don't mind either, but... It must have been a relief.
Well, he was completely unexpected, you know, a really tough New York taxi driver and talking out of the side of his mouth with a cigar and says, yeah, do you want to hear the variations now?
I love it. Tell me something. Where are your papers? Where are all your things from all of the years gone by? Have you given them to a university?
Well, actually, the University of Toronto bailed me out of poverty about 12 years ago by buying a bunch of my papers and laundry lists and old napkins and things that I put.
They really want things like that, don't they?
That was a wonderful moment, and I thought, I have a whole bunch of new stuff, maybe I can sell it to them again. But a lot of them are in Montreal and in Greece and various suitcases here and there where people are holding them for me.
Yeah, just keep this for me for a couple of years?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Well, are you a pack rat type, or do you keep things?
Yeah, I tend to keep everything. I tend to keep all the letters I'm going to answer.
Mm-hmm. Any minute now.
Any minute now.
Yeah, boxes of them from years and years ago. Yeah. Never got answered. But as far as the papers are concerned, I mean, apart from bailing you out and giving you something tangible with which to pay the light bill, they've got to look at it as in a sense of posterity. I mean, this is a guy that is important to us, and we need his stuff. But the point of all of this rattling on is, I just wonder how you consider yourself, historically speaking, how the world will view you in some hundred years.
That's a good, you know, you go from very inflated views of yourself to all the way down to the other side. Sometimes I feel that those papers are more important than anything else I put out, where they could be looked at not from the point of view of literature or of excellence, but just of the point of view of somebody who's kept a very careful record of their thoughts and experiences. I think it might be useful from that point of view.
Do you keep a diary?
Well, in a sense, so it's one big diary, you know, set to guitar music.
Oh, God, you're such a poet. I'm always terrified of poets. I always think they know something I don't know, that I won't understand what they're writing. I get a book of poetry in the mail, and I think, ooh.
I feel the same way about poetry. You know? The only thing that comforts me a bit is the thought that most poetry isn't any good, and that the form is so seductive. And so many people try it out, and that really there are only a few here and there who can master it. So with that sense of comfort, I pick up a book, and if I don't understand it, which is often the case, I just let it go down.
Well, they recall, I mean, most often I get things that, and they recall and conjure up names of figures from the Grecian past about which I have no information at all. I don't know what the hell they're talking about, and they could very well be making a great pun or a great observation, and it just zooms right over my little head.
Yes, it's unpleasant to find a poet that's better educated than you are.
Somehow they like to flaunt it.
Yeah, there is that. That still resides in a lot of poetry, which, you know, that aspect of elitism where there's an assumption that there's a vast common culture and that we all participate in it. Unfortunately, things are a little more fragmented now, and, you know, most people know Mr. T and things like that.
Mr. T. You, of music, you are working on a new record, or it's out?
No, I'm just finishing it up now. It should be out in the fall. I think they're going to release it.
What is it of? Give me a notion of what will happen.
It's called Various Positions, and it's coming out on CBS, and just a record. Songs, new songs.
You play any guitar?
Playing guitar and quite a few of them, yeah.
Do you have a tape with you? Do you have any sign of it? I mean, could we play something later on?
Yeah, I've got some rough mixes here. I think I had them here.
Yes, carrying them around in your pocket, your rough mixes?
Yeah, well, it's just a cassette of the rough mixes because I've been studying them on the road now because I'm going back to the studio to sweeten them up a bit.
Yeah. You carry them around your pocket. Those are not the masters one would pray. No, certainly not. Have you ever written anything for kids?
No, I've made up quite a few stories to tell my own children.
How old are they now?
9 and 11.
Young still?
Young still, yeah.
Do you see them? Do you live with them?
I don't live with them, but I manage to see them every day.
Oh, well, that's lucky, I suppose. Yeah. But if you live in Greece...
No, I've been living mostly Montreal and New York. Now they're going to school in New York. They lived in the south of France for a long time. They went to school there.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why I got the trailer to live nearby.
Papa comes over for a story reading?
Yeah, or they come. They love to come over to the caravan.
I'll bet they do. Yeah. It's fun over there.
Yeah.
And it probably rocks.
Yeah, in the wind, yeah, it does.
And if you jump up and down lots, it probably does too. Do you not live on Hydra anymore?
I haven't been living in Greece for a while, although I have taken the kids there for the summer now and then.
What about concertizing? When was the last time you did that?
The last time I went out was with my last record, which was 79-80. I did about 100 concerts in Europe and Australia. And I'll go out again with this new record in September. I'll do Europe in the fall and Australia in the winter and hopefully North America in the spring.
Does it throw you when you have such a long time in between performances? I mean, a weekend almost kills me to come back and try it again.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I think that's why I have a band. Otherwise, I'd do the whole thing with my own guitar. But, you know, the first two or three concerts, my fingers won't work.
Yeah.
And I'm very nervous, yeah.
Were you nervous when you worked with Phil Spector?
I was very, very nervous. Very nervous that one of his guns would go off.
Does he get guns?
In the recording studio, it looked like a small arsenal. He was carrying a gun, and three or four bodyguards were carrying guns. And there were bullets falling on the floor, you know. And as the evening drew on and the Manischewitz wine was... consumed.
How can you drink that stuff?
I didn't drink it.
No.
And a lot of it, you know, got very loose and, things got a little bit dangerous.
Does he appear to, this is a fair number of years ago. When was it?
Yeah.
77 or so?
77, I think I made that record, yeah.
He is all but disappeared, as you know. He's a total recluse.
Yes, he stays in this big house that he keeps at about 32 degrees.
Fahrenheit?
Yeah. It's very, very cold. I mean, after you get to know Phil a while, you take a fur coat when you go visit him.
Why does he do that?
He locks the door. It doesn't let you out. He locks the door.
Oh, how nice.
It's hazardous.
But why is it so cold? Did you ask him? Did you say, how come it's so cold in here?
I don't know. You know, he really is a magnificent eccentric.
Mm-hmm.
And to work with him just by himself is really delightful. We wrote those songs together over a space of a few months, and when I'd visit him, you know, we'd have really good times and work till late in the morning. But when he got into the studio, he moved into a different gear, and he became very exhibitionistic and very mad. And I lost the handle on the record completely. He would take it away. He would take the tapes away every day, every night under armed guard. And then he mixed it in secret. He wouldn't let me in.
Well, did you kick and scream, beg?
He disappeared. I couldn't find him. And, you know, I was stuck with the option after a lot of work, a year's work, either to say no or just to let it go out as it was. And I thought it was good enough to let go out, but it wasn't at all what I thought it could have been. I thought the instinct was good for both of us to work with each other. And I think the songs are very, very good, but I think that the voice is lost in the mix, and it's just a matter of turning the right dials.
Maybe he wanted you to disappear. Who knows?
I think he wanted me to disappear. Well, one time he came over to me about 4 a.m. with half a bottle of Manischewitz in one hand and a 45 in the other. And he put his arm around my shoulder and shoved the nozzle of the 45 into my neck and cocked it and said, "I love you, Leonard."
Oh, my God. Were there ever any moments in your life when you thought you could get that mad? Were you ever that much on the edge?
Well, his madness, has a kind of theatrical expression.
Right.
Mine tends to get very silent.
Oh, don't get silent yet.
Okay.
No. Just 5 more minutes.
Okay.
But have you ever thought you were going mad?
I think you do have those feelings from time to time, yeah.
I think you do.
Yeah.
You never contemplated ending at all?
No. I've been taught somehow or acquired the notion that it's not the right thing to do.
Yes. I think you're right. Are you afraid to die?
No.
I mean, that may sound like an asinine question, but...
I think that Leighton put it very nicely. He has a poem addressed to Sir Mortimer, mm-hmm. who is death, and he said, I don't mind dying, but it's the preliminaries that I'm worried about.
Do you see Leighton a lot?
I haven't seen him in the past year, and I've missed him very much. I've tried to make contact, but his former wife Betty died when I was when he'd moved to Montreal, and when I came, he was down at the funeral there. But I do want to see him in the next week or two. Yeah.
When did you first meet him? You must have been a youth.
I was about 17 when I met him. I guess it was in my second or third year of college, and I was writing poetry, and he was one of the lights around the city.
Did you take him your stuff?
No, I never had that kind of association with mm-hmm. him. We never had a student-teacher association.
Right.
We became friends right off and would meet at Murray's, or he'd come over to my room on Peel Street where I was living, and we'd show each other poems. There was never any... That was one of the aspects of his generosity, even though he was and probably is a more accomplished writer than I am. There was never the sense that I was bringing my stuff to him.
At university, were you considered a curiosity, even at 17 and 18?
No, I don't know, maybe I was, but certainly among my friends and the people I knew, there was no attempt of any of us to stand out in any special way. We thought we were sort of living Brideshead Revisited.
Is that so?
At McGill University. This was before Sputnik.
Oh, after Boaters, but before Sputnik.
Yeah, it was before the universities began to get anxious about what they were teaching. And it was a very relaxed situation. And I think we spent most of the time listening to that Rodrigo guitar concerto and drinking wine and writing poetry and chasing after girls.
Which you did. You made almost could have made a living at. I mean, you
I
have
know.
Quite a reputation. Things have calmed down,
I
understand.
I don't know if it was a living.
But you have calmed down. You've cooled your jets, as youths will say today.
Yeah, I guess so.
Have you?
Yeah, not really. But,
have you not?
Well, in this respect, you mean? In the respect of womanizing?
Yeah.
I'm very excited by women, but I guess the activity has declined somehow.
Well, we won't carry on with that. When you were in university, what did you think you were going to do with yourself? Did you think, I'll make my living as a poet, as a writer, or I'll drive cab, or I'll work in my family
yeah.
business, or what?
I thought I would make it as a writer. There was never really anything else that I considered.
Did you ever do any real job?
Oh, yeah. I ran an elevator, and I worked in factories, and I did counseling at camps, and, you know, I did a lot of odd jobs. I did radio journalism for a while.
You did?
I did just about anything. You know, in the first 5 or 6 years when I went to Greece for a number of reasons. One of them was economic, and I'd come back to Canada, and I'd put together $600 or $700, and I'd go back to Greece, and I could live for a year on that.
No
I was
kidding.
Living for $1,200 a year. So I'd sell a story to Cavalier or something like that and get $700, or do a piece for the CBC and get $300 or $400, and that way I was able to live for a number of years and write.
So you don't mind the Spartan existence then?
Well, I have always been attracted to the voluptuousness of austerity.
Aha. Uh-huh.
I think that, you know, I never chose the style of my life because it hurt. It was on the contrary. I feel most comfortable and most most abundant when things are very simple and I know where everything is and there's nothing around that I don't need.
You're not interested in mirrored walls and plush carpets and that kind of thing?
No, I don't feel comfortable in those. It's pleasant to visit a well-appointed house, but for my own self, I'd like to have it rather bare.
What do you do today, for instance? This is work, what you and I are doing.
Yes, sure.
But will you work today? Will you write anything today?
Well, I won't write, maybe on the airplane. That's always a good time, because I'm going to Winnipeg tonight. That's quite a long trip, maybe. But
what happened to Edmonton and Calgary?
Yeah, Winnipeg, Edmonton, Calgary. Winnipeg, Calgary, and Edmonton. I have my little Walkman and earphones, and there's a couple of lyrics that aren't finished on my record, so I'll probably work on those.
You don't socialize on the plane and chat up everybody?
No, I find it difficult to talk because of the noise.
I like to concentrate fully on keeping the plane up.
Yes, it's very, very, a very good idea.
I know. Don't laugh. I've noticed, I went through quite a few clippings, as you might see here, old ones, new ones. And apart from the review kind of stories that they do about you, saying this is a work of bravery, this is and all that garbage, people that do feature stories on you always want to say how you're dressed. Have you noticed that? They always want to describe...
They review my suit.
Yes, they do. They review your suit. For instance, when you were staying at the King Eddie and you were shooting some picture there, I am a hotel.
Yeah.
Which I should ask you about, but they just instantly described what you were wearing and how dignified you were and how things had changed and you were less scruff and your hair was cut and shaved and that you were chameleon-like and every time they saw you were different.
I don't know. I've been wearing the same suit for years.
You look like you're from Marseille, to tell you the truth. But they like to know what you're wearing.
Well, I usually wear a suit. I emerged before blue jeans, and I was never very comfortable in that. And I like a slightly formal cast to things. A double-breasted suit is I've always felt good in.
You should be wearing a black shirt and a white tie, carrying a small violin case.
Well, I put on a gray shirt this morning, but I don't know, it didn't go with the rain.
No, you should never hear. It's a lesson to be learned for living in British Columbia. You should never paint a room gray.
Yeah.
I did this because the sky is gray, the room is gray, everything, the carpet is gray, everything is gray. I made this mistake. All right, I am a hotel. What has become of that?
It was chosen as Canada's entry to the Montreal Television Festival. I don't think it's very good. I think it's respectable television, but it was the first time I got into it, and I didn't really know what I was doing. And I kind of lost the handle on the thing.
That's the second time you've said that.
Yeah, well, these handles are elusive.
They fall off. You worked on a picture that was shot here where you did the music for it, for Altman. Was it McCabe and Mrs. Miller you did?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Bob Altman wrote the film while listening to that record that a lot of those songs were on, and he asked me if I could use the music. I was in a studio in Tennessee. I was recording one of my albums there, and I got a call from this guy called Bob Altman. And that afternoon, I'd gone to see Brewster McLeod. I just stepped into a theater, and I'd sat through it twice. And he said, "Can I use this music?" I said, "I don't know what you've done." He said, "Well, I did MASH." I said, "I heard it was a grand success, but I didn't see it. Is there anything else I might have seen?" He said, "I did another picture that you wouldn't have seen because nobody liked it, called Brewster McLeod." So I said, "Take anything."
Take me, I'm yours.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I wrote, then I recorded a couple of extra guitar pieces for Warren Beatty's monologue and a few things like that. But mostly they were just lifted off the record.
Do you go to movies? Did you when you were a kid? You're obviously not a movie fanatic.
I'm not a fanatic, but there's a great song by Loudon Wainwright, "The Movies Are a Mother to Me." It's a nice place to cool out in.
Yeah, it's safe. It feels safe.
Yeah.
Did you do the opera with Louis Fury?
Yeah, I wrote the lyrics to an idea that he had. He wrote the book and conceived of the thing, and I was doing an experiment in Spenserian stanzas, which is an old form of very tight interlocking lines, and so I wrote most of the lyrics in these Spenserian stanzas.
What status has it now, the opera?
It seems that it's going to be a Franco-Canadian television show. I think they're going to be filming at the end of the summer.
Why don't you do a video? That's what somebody asked me. I was panicking all weekend long, thinking of what the heaven's name I was going to ask you. I made notes on toilet paper, on martini blotters, everywhere. And then last night, I thought, I'll just write them all down and try and figure out what I'm going to do with this guy. Are you going to do a video or what? You'd be perfect.
Well, this little show for the CBC was designed with that in mind. I wanted to make a long piece, that kind of video. It isn't too successful, but with the new material, I'd like to try it again.
Now, when I solicited assistance from some of my friends, they wanted to know. For example, Randy Newman. You like Randy Newman?
Oh, he's very fine, yeah.
He is, isn't he?
Yeah, very fine writer and singer and arranger.
Have you ever met him?
I think we were recording at A&M Studios in Los Angeles once, and we shook each other's hand, but I don't know him as a man, no.
He hasn't broken through, I mean, to appeal to a great number of people. I mean,
well, he did have a top 40 hit a couple of years ago with Short People.
Yes, he got in all kinds of hassle about that one, too. You ever gotten in any trouble? I mean, where the public said, you are really beyond the pale, you've just gone too far.
No, I don't think so. You know, during the great Maoist period in France, where I have a fair audience, I used to get accused of being a bourgeois individualist and that sort of thing, but nothing really directly to a song.
New Shoes will do that to the French communists. Yeah. They will accuse you of being a bourgeois. Well, I will release you from this. I thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Coming in.